Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. I remember it's the OIG Roundtable because I have Matt, Wade, and Jason here, so that's how I know it's the OIG Roundtable. Not to be confused with any of the other podcasts that we do. Today, we're going to be talking a lot over the next little bit about training in the SIU, the importance of training, the importance of mandatory training, the importance of consistency in training, and the like. As always, I'm joined by the full group here. I got Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge over at the OIG from the LA office, now one of our SIU team members. Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director and one of the managers over on our SIU team. And Jason Eisengrind, also one of our retired executives from HHS OIG and the retired UPIC West director, and our special director in charge running some special projects and the like. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, unless something has changed on my birth certificate. And I am the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. So today's podcast, we want to talk about training. Now, training transcends a lot of things, regardless of what your job is in an SIU world, even as an OIG agent. There's mandatory training and the importance of training and the reinforcement of training. And it really does start on day one and having that level set and getting everybody on the same page. Now, at the OIG, we didn't just receive a lot of training, but we were also responsible for conducting a lot of training, because at the OIG, we were the agency responsible as the primary agency in the government for fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance-related matters, criminal, civil, and administrative, regarding programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. And so oftentimes, the OIG would be called upon to assist and provide and lead training of U.S. attorney's offices, the FBI, MFUCUs, and commercial payers and the like. So, Wade, I want to start with you, because you were involved a lot in L.A. with kind of helping bring that training out as best practices, right? And so talk a little bit about some of the things that you thought were important pieces of that puzzle to get everybody on that same page for that level playing field across the partners.
Yeah, I think there's a couple different areas to focus on. One is just in terms of like liability. We had to do a lot of training regarding, you know, firearms, defensive tactics, those types of things. But beyond those, which were generally like quarterly training, we tended to do it a little bit more than quarterly and try to mix it up a little bit, other than just have qualifications and stuff. But more towards the actual training on investigations and things of that nature, it was a high priority for the OIG, a lot more than what I see now in the MCOs as far as wanting to invest resources. Like you had mentioned, we not only received a lot of training to try and get everybody kind of on the same page and kind of at the same level, but we also gave training to other partners, you know, with the MFUCUs or people at the U.S. Attorney's Office. So it was a big part of what we did. We invested a lot of resources. And I think in the corporate world, it's kind of looked at from a different angle, where anytime that's, you know, anytime that's training is time away from actually working the cases. And that was true with the OIG as well, but it's like a necessary, you know, it's necessary. Without that training, I see a lot of a lack of consistency. You know, there's different, I think a lot of the people that come in to work for the MCOs are retired, or at least they have a history of working these types of cases. So it's less crucial to teach like general fraud investigations, because I think everybody has a pretty good handle on that. But I think it's more specific to the office or the MCO, and that then you get into like the documentation, where I see a lot of inconsistencies. There might be templates and things of that nature to try and, you know, keep people on the same page, but the actual content of the documents, there's really no we used to like to call them go-bys with the OIG. You never really started a letter from scratch. You used one as an example and kind of tweaked it. So there are templates, but beyond the template where it just has like some general like recurring information, the actual content, I think, is one thing that I think there could be more training on that. And generally, I would say there's a lack of onboarding training as compared to what we did with the OIG.
Yeah, I think the take home that we've seen is from the MCO perspective is budget constraints, right? Resource constraints. That when you brought it, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head that when you're providing training to your staff, they're not doing the job that they were hired to do. So the work kind of piles up during those periods of time, you know, where training exists. But what, you know, I think what we've seen from some of the SIU improvement process improvement projects we've worked on is that generally speaking, we find that SIUs where they have the strongest struggle is efficiency of the unit, meaning that you've got people that are doing so many different things and wear so many different hats that they're not able to focus on the job that they're doing, right? We have one plan where some of the investigators believe that greater than 30 or 40% of their workday was spent on things other than doing their investigations, administrative things, vetting complaints, which could be considered kind of quasi part of their job, but that there just wasn't the ability to do that. And I think for a lot of the payers that are out there, you know, at the OIG, we were, you know, we're government funded. If there's a week of training and it's mandatory training, you're going, you're doing it. And I think that's why there was a heavy reliance in some of the space to have the OIG do the training because it was free training, right? And as long as you were a partner agency, you were typically going to get a little bit of a break on that. But I think it starts day one, whether it's an MCO or whatever. At the OIG, we had something called the Office of Investigations Policies and Procedures Manual. It was kind of the go-by of how to be an investigator. It was everything from documenting cases to entering information and doing the like. And I think that starts day one, right? Investigators on their first day as part of their orientation should be given the policies and procedures for the MCO and understand you don't have to memorize it, but you've at least got to be familiar with it. And that by not having certain things given to you, that sets you on a path where if you're not trained well from the first day, it's, you know, it's going to kind of, you know, morph itself. So Jason, I want to turn to you now, because one of the things that is out there that's an important piece of this puzzle, it's not just training, but it's the reinforcement of training, right? And I used the term before we got on for the recording, and I said perishable skills, right? At the OIG, there was 4 times a year firearms training. CPR was every year or so, we would recertify the CPR training and some of these other things. And there's this constant need to build on the skills that you have, because these skills tend to go away if you get rusty, right? If you're not spending every day using Excel and you go for a month or two without doing a pivot chart, maybe you've gotten a little rusty on it. So, and I know that was an important piece for you from the training perspective.
Yes. And I like to reinforce what has already been said, which is that there is an absolute need for the training, and yet it's very expensive. So the conundrum lies in how much is too much training and how much is not enough. And unfortunately, the not enough identification is usually realized in some sort of nonconformity or quality lapse or something like that, because in pretty much any root cause analysis I've ever done in those situations, it turns out that it's about communication and training. And obviously communication and training are very much linked together. So, and yes, I've actually done studies not that long ago, frankly, in another operation. And it was about 72% of the time was spent on actual casework, and the rest of it was other duties as assigned, much of it being training related, meetings and things like that. So, you know, you need to really roll your sleeves up. You need to conduct studies, identify those quality lapses, and then identify the training needs that will mitigate those lapses. I will say also that in terms of the training, and I hate to sound like my old Mr. Thompson in the eighth grade, when he would routinely say, okay, take out a sheet of paper and number 1 to 10 and put your name at the top. But the reality is a lot of training is this, you know, funnel method of training where someone is just speaking. And of course, nowadays it's going to be virtual potentially, or most often. And everyone's busy. I'm not suggesting that it's just illegitimate things that people are diverting their attention to, but you know, they've got a lot on their plate. So they look at it as a time where they might be able to do two things at once. And the reality is that it's very important that the training is being captured and absorbed by the attendees. So Eric, you mentioned firearms, the defensive tactics, and there were tests. There were, you know, CPR is a test. You know, anything that has a note of seriousness and really needed for the operation to be successful, it requires a competency of what it is you're trying to communicate.
Well, and you know, the piece of that is actually relevant on the provider side is, you know, we do a ton of work where we're doing education and training with providers, right? Documentation, training, and education to ensure that they're coding correctly to the documentation and taking that holistic 360-degree view, right? That a provider is not just billing to the code that they think they did, but they're documenting and looking at that in a symbiotic fashion. And I don't think that when you're doing training and then testing for training, it's no different than when you're doing something on the provider side. We do education and training for a provider, and then 6 months later, we re-audit them. Did the training take? And not only did the training take, but did it stick, right? And that's and whether it's SIU provider side, it's this kind of constant ebb and flow of that training to reinforce that, you know, those skills. And it could be even things like, you know, learning some new aspect of a fraud scheme, right? If you've worked on a couple of podiatry cases, do you take a training class on the podiatry fraud schemes? If you're working a case that involves spinal injections, are you taking a course on the CPT coding for spinal injections or something along those lines, right? So it's this constant updating of that knowledge base to be fresh to what's happening. And that, I think, is, you know, unfortunately, when we talk about mandatory training, each year, it's typically the same things over and over again. And that's where that reinforcement comes in. So we see a constant reinforcement of training for things like privacy and security, HIPAA. Those are the big ones, right? Every year, you've got to do that at the OIG. We'd have to do it. But it always comes with a price, right? So there's the opportunity cost of not being able to do the work that you're supposed to do. Jason, you just talked about, you know, a study that you did where greater than 20, you know, coming around 25%, you know, 20-25% of the time, people weren't working on the things that they should have been working on. And so it's the mandatory training, it's that. And then Matt, I want to go to you because you worked on a lot of the training stuff over at the Northeast UPIC, and you and I are actually working right now. We're going to be providing for one of our SIU clients. We're going to be providing a 3-day on-site for them. And it's really going to be a mini version of the training that mirrors what's done at the Special Agent Basic Training for OIG agents or at the IG Academy at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, where we're going to be doing a whole slew of training. And so let's talk a little bit about not just the mandatory, but the importance of that level playing field for a few reasons, the least of which is organizational credibility.
Yeah, I mean, you look at an SIU, the people they bring in have a variety of backgrounds. Some of them have incredible experience in, you know, insurance, healthcare fraud investigations from an SIU perspective. Others are coming from law enforcement. Others are coming from local law enforcement, you know, detectives and such. There's no baseline of knowledge that's been established. So having, again, going back to day one training, you need to have a baseline that everybody has an understanding of what the program is, what the SIU does, what the roles and responsibilities are, all the way down to what are the processes we have in place. How do you conduct an interview? How do you document that interview? How do you do an on-site? What goes into a medical review? What are the policies and procedures that are needed to get a case from point A to resolution? And then how do you investigate these cases? You know, a detective coming in from, you know, New York City, they're not going to know what an E&M is or what a, you know, what a incident two case is all about. They're going to need to become subject matter experts in each of those things. So you can't teach them all of those things because the variety of cases is endless. You have to teach them, how do I do the research necessary to become a SME for this particular case? You know, what are my resources to go to research the law, the regulation, the policies for this particular instance? And that's what we were doing at the UPIC, is we had onboarding training, which was like Medicare 101 and then UPIC 101, along with, going back to the FLETC days, a 13-stage training regimen, which included a mock investigation. You know, here's a complaint. Here's the data. What do you do with it? And you train them through that, and then they had, you know, they had interviews. They would have the medical review results that they would go through with the clinician on, you know, what are they looking at here? How does this relate back to the allegation? They would work the data with a data analyst. We would have mock interviews with role players, and those would be critiqued. You know, then they would write up the interview reports, and the interview reports would be critiqued. What is needed there? What's the germane information that you should have put that you didn't? What's the stuff that, you know, you can leave out? The old shovel versus the trowel form of information. You can throw everything in there, but the important stuff gets lost. So you have to highlight what's germane to the investigation, bringing it back to the, you know, the allegation and all that, all the way through to how do you put a referral together for law enforcement that's going to be, you know, something that they're going to want to see. And so that training was very important. It did cost a lot of resources. But when I took over from the UPIC, at the UPIC, the CPAR scores, which are those tests that you're talking about, they were okay. They're not great, not bad. Once we started this training, and then we built into it, not just initially, but we built a training regimen with ongoing training throughout the year on subjects that Excel, documentation. If we had a specific scheme that kept popping up, had training on that, and it went throughout the year. And then we had a huge documentation push where we taught folks how to document their files, how to write interview reports, how to write on-site reports, how to write referrals. And then we had quality assurance tests every month where a sample of the sample of our files were reviewed and they were scored. And if the scores were low and we saw a pattern of, oh, these are the things we're missing, we had training on it. And the CPAR scores went way up. The number of referrals and the quality of the referrals we were putting out to the OIG went up. And, you know, so we showed a lot of improvement. It costs resources, but it really showed the benefit.
Yeah. And you know, that really lends itself to that credibility, and it lends itself, when there's consistency, it lends to the credibility, because the consistency is very, very important. You know, I know we've done training before where we show up to an SIU and there's 10 people in the room and you ask a question and you get 10 people giving 25 different answers, right? Mm-hmm. There's just a lack of consistency. And you see that oftentimes in documentation. And it's not just in documenting an interview or how you did it, but it's, what do you do with the notes? Are you handwriting notes? What are you doing with those handwritten notes when you're done? Are you typing in your interview as you do it? Is it live? Is it contemporaneous? Are you recording them, audio, video? What's your policy on that? There's a ton of stuff. You know, and wait, so just going back to you on that consistency. So you and I were both enforcement or operational type instructors, right? You were a firearms guy. I was defensive tactics and the baton and the pepper. And I would find, as I'm sure you did, that each quarter there were a group of people where it was like Groundhog Day. Each quarter you were having to reinforce the same skill set in those people. And I equate that to, in the SIU world, that the learning curve for some people is very high, but the retention curve for some people is even higher. And so that constant reinforcement of a skill is an important piece. Now, you know, there are a lot of ways that SIUs can develop financial efficiencies on some of those trainings where it doesn't cost as much, or they're more like vignettes. Sometimes they'll call them micro learnings, right? Where it's like a 5-minute video or something along those lines. So Jason, I want to give you the last word before we shut down. What are some of your key areas, number one, that you think this has got to be done on a regular basis to reinforce that training? And then the other kind of collateral piece is, how do you do that within the confines of a limited budget?
Well, I would focus on medical review for a moment, because what Matt was talking about, and that sounded like an awesome program that he put together there. I will say that there's a concept in medical review called inter-rater reliability. And the inter-rater reliability is a methodology where you assess over a period of time individuals' competencies in those areas. And that way you can have a more targeted, specific application of the training. So it might be that one person needs a lot more work in a particular thing, but another person has it mastered. And so maybe there's a stepped up program for person one over person two. So again, it sounds a little, like a little bit down in the weeds and minutia, but ultimately, because it is a really expensive thing to provide, with, you know, the amount of training that we're all talking about here, this way you're maybe minimizing it for those that they're just rolling their eyes, right? I mean, and certain things, of course, you can't get away from, you know, whether it's, you know, appropriate behavior in the workplace or IT and computer security, things like that, even if it is just, you know, eye rolling at times, it's just that important that you can't let it slip. But maybe there are other things that can be put aside for those that have developed significant mastery of those specific areas.
Yeah, that's an important piece, is you don't want to the people that are operationally working at a proper operational tempo, you don't want to punish them by making them go through additional reinforcement training, you know, but you want to at least capitalize on the people that could learn something from that, and then figuring out who those people are. You know, someone once told me years ago, it wasn't you, Jason, because I know most of the things that I've learned, you know, or most things that I'll say people say come from you. But, you know, someone once said that even bad training is good training, because it at least teaches you what you shouldn't be doing. If it was bad training, you at least know what not to do. And I think it really does. It does work both ways. But I do think, to kind of close this out, the challenge for an SIU is budgetary and resource management. Those are huge, right? Because your budgets are not great for something like necessarily training. And then when you do have a budget to provide people with that training and education, is how do you do it in a cost-effective manner, but also how do you do it where your resources aren't going to be allocated to that training for such an inordinate amount of time that they're functionally useless, other than new people, right? Like, you know, when a new agent gets hired at the OIG, they go through, you know, it amounts to probably close to 5 or 6 months of training. You've got the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which is now a 3-month-long academy. You've got the special agent basic training, which is anywhere between 4 and 6 weeks or so. And then when budget allows, you'll see people sometimes go to the IG Academy, which is an additional 2 weeks. So by the time you're done, you've got 6 months of training. The person has been a allocated resource, but they're functionally useless during that training period. And then once they get on board, how long is it until they're actually functionally valuable? And I think that on a different level, it's similar in the MCO world, right? I mean, it's not a 6-month training, but if you've got somebody who's been an NYPD detective for their whole career and they've done a great job that way, they may know how to interview people and talk to people, but if they've never looked at a CPT or a HCPCS code, their value is no different than someone who's 23 years old out of college who's never looked at a CPT code. So that training in the MCO world becomes a very fine balance from all of those aspects. So, you know, I think as we start to do more of these SIU process improvement projects, we start to really hone in on a lot of that. We're seeing that on the one project that we're going to be doing, Matt and I, for our one client for 3 days, where they really want to have an absolute level setting. They've got people that have been there for 20 years that are, you know, at this point now should be humming along, but are you know, just doggy paddling their way around because they haven't really gotten deep into the swim. So hopefully we'll be able to see some changes with that. So Well, as always, these conversations go, and I think we could talk for a long time about them. It's always great to talk to you guys. It's always great to get the insight on these things. And, you know, I learn something each time I speak to each one of you. So as always, I'm glad to spend this time with you. I look forward to our next podcast. Again, for those of you that aren't getting our newsletter, you can get us at hello@advisehealth.com. Sign up for our newsletter. You can get that every week. You can also get our prior podcasts as well as our LinkedIn Lives. You can get those recorded and get those off of our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube. You can subscribe to the Advise Health YouTube channel and get all that information. So we'll see you on the next podcast, and we'll see you in May for our next LinkedIn Live. Everybody have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.